From Sapporo, Japan, this is Arado Debito talking to you, courtesy of Trans-Pacific Radio. This is the Debito.org podcast for October 31st, 2009. Yes, it's been a long, long time, almost 2 years since I've done one of these. One of the reasons is that podcasts take a long time to edit. I'm going to have fewer bells and whistles and just more articles from now. I've also got a new column in the Japan Times called Just Because, which has gone on for almost 2 years now as well. And I've built up a bank of about 21 columns to read from. Let me read three of them today, and we can look back and see how well they stand up over 2 years. This is from the Japan Times, Wednesday, March 5th, 2008. It's my very first community page column, Just Because. Dusting off the A word. Causes are what activists take up as a matter of course. But in Japan, just doing that is a challenge, given the general aversion towards activism here. I've been called an activisto for many years. At first I was leery of the label because of its negative ring in Japanese. Even its vernacular equivalents, katsudouka, undouka, even proshimin, which is professional citizen, a negative term like do-gooder, make activist sound like extremist or kagekiha. No wonder. Civil society, non-governmental or non-profit organizations, networks and voluntary associations promoting a common good, is curiously underdeveloped in Japan. Sure, volunteer groups have long existed in Japan, but the father-knows-best paternalism still found in our bureaucracy precluded much grassroots philanthropy. NGOs and NPOs weren't even allowed official registration until a decade ago. To most people, acting in the public interest wasn't our job, it was the government's, and our government, believe it or not, was once seen as practically infallible. From the 1950s to the late 1980s, the best and the brightest were mandarins creating good industrial policy. Most people cashed in on the high-growth economy instead of helping those less fortunate in the society, such as the homeless, the handicapped, and other groups that faced discrimination. Even after the bubble burst and faith in the government dimmed, many still had difficulty believing that certain problems, such as racial discrimination towards the growing number of non-Japanese residents, even existed in Japan. After all, standardized education said that racial discrimination was an overseas phenomenon, epitomized by the American South under segregation and apartheid-era South Africa. The Anna Bortz and Otada Onsen's lawsuits, where our judiciary openly acknowledged that Japanese-only establishments were discriminating by race, removed a lot of plausible deniability. But even today, Japan officially claims to the United Nations that there are no real ethnic minorities in Japan, ergo, no racial discrimination. Frictions and quote-unquote gaijin allergies are mainly due to misunderstandings by Johnny Foreigner, unable to grasp our unique culture. Mandarin say, public do. In any public discussion on why exclusionary signs stay up on shop fronts, justifications turn to culture, too automatically, which means an activist has an uphill slog convincing people why they should care. But I believe the biggest reason why activism in general is so frowned upon in Japan is because it has no history of resounding success. In the West, the anti-Vietnam War movement of the late 1960s is held up as the paragon of a successful demonstration of people power. Speeches, public demos, and conscientious objectionism helped topple administrations, such as Lyndon Johnson in the U.S., Charles de Gaulle in France, for example, and change political landscapes. People engaging in peaceful protest, for a cause now vindicated in popular culture, is part of the historical narrative. Activism isn't even all that scary. The sky won't fall in because people pick it. It's even seen as a benign phase that students go through. Contrast that with the demonstrations against the revision of the U.S.-Japan Security Treaty in the late 1950s and early 1960s. Japan's biggest street protests. There were student riots, huge rifts in society, and even violence and deaths. However, these struggles didn't amount to much. We are still under the security treaty. The perpetually empowered big cheeses in the Liberal Democratic Party have never been toppled by street demonstrations. Instead, left-wing extremists cleaved into camps, most famously the Japanese Red Army, turned on themselves in murderous purges, and set off bombs and riots that maimed authority figures and bystanders alike. In doing so, they destroyed any positive image of civil disobedience. So with no clear example of activism, quote-unquote, working in Japan, it's difficult to argue that causes are worth the time and energy. Instead of being heroic, they're associated with rioting extremists. When I eventually took on the mantle of activist, my cause is, of course, establishing a law against racial discrimination in Japan, I found that I must constantly dispel the image that I'm doing anything extreme. I'm just doing what other fellow Japanese, however few, are doing within the law and the Constitution. That means lobbying politicians, notifying ministries, naming and shaming discriminating businesses, and crafting essays and websites as a permanent record for future researchers, even if it means I'm swimming against the current, perpetually gainsaid by naysayers because they are apathetic, cynical, culturally relativistic, or debate dilettantes. This monthly column will be part of that essay writing effort, discussing things that matter to Japan's ever-growing non-Japanese communities. I hope to spark debate about what should be by now obvious in any developed society, that everyone, regardless of nationality, national origin, or any immutable social status affixed at birth, should get a fair chance at reaching their potential in society. That's not obvious in Japan because too few people actively push for it. I'll write because it's a just cause. Or even, just because. That was my first Just Because column back in March 5th, 2008. I hope you enjoyed it. Let's go to my second one. This is from April 2nd, 2008, and it's entitled Public Forums, Spinning Wheels. A friend sent me a Yomiuri article, February 10th, 2008, about a neighborhood forum in Kanazawa. Its title, Citizens Consider How to Live Together with Foreigners. I'm pleased this event was deemed worth a write-up. After all, I've witnessed plenty of forums over the years that have been ignored. But it wasn't really what I would call news. I couldn't help feeling that attendees were just, quote-unquote, reinventing the wheel, rather than developing a vehicle that would actually get us anywhere. The Kanazawa Forum was reportedly warm and fuzzy. 70 people discussed how to make the area a nicer place, with Japanese and non-Japanese participating in good old machizukuri, which is town building. International communication starts with us, inside us, sort of thing. It had the bromides about how people find it difficult dealing with different languages and cultures, and giving birth to all sorts of dreadful misunderstandings. The conclusion? It's best to get together and talk more often. Kumbaya. I've been through these gab fests before, and it's made me a tad curmudgeonly. It's like karaoke where the only song available is Yesterday, a conversation that never gets beyond talk of food and chopstick use, a class full of permanent beginners. In other words, it's a constantly repeating cycle without progress. I was a panelist at another one of these get-togethers recently in Saitama. Organized by some very earnest and eager people, it was bursting with panelists to the point where we had too many cooks, stewing over how nice and peaceful yet standoffish Japanese society can be. It was a cookie cutter of Kanazawa, except for the presence of a snooty young local diet member who mouthed platitudes about how tough things must be for everyone, including the Japanese who have to clean up after foreigners. At that point, I began wool-gathering, recalling all the warm, fuzzy forums I'd seen turn into woolly-headed worry sessions, and arrived at a sad conclusion. They're wasted opportunities. For even if these events are put on by people genuinely concerned about the welfare of non-Japanese residents, not the local government, internationalization old boys justifying budgets for parties and overseas trips. If one is not careful, the agenda will go on autopilot, bogged down in banalities. For example, the discussion invariably focuses on the cultural differences, rather than similarities, the conflicts that arise when foreigners enter the picture. After all, people love drama. A perennial hot topic is the consequences of juxtaposing gaijin with burnable garbage sorting. You know, they go together like steak and eggs. And gee whiz, Japanese language is muzukashi and people can't speak goodly. The hopeful undercurrent is that communication will ultimately fix all. Well, communicating will indeed fix most, but not all. And I don't mean to rein in anyone's matsuri, as these forums are indubitably good things, but someday they must get beyond the permanent beginner and cultural ambassador stage, because there are situations where mere talk will not work. Bonafide racists and paranoid shopkeepers exist out there, as they do in any society. They will not accept people under any terms who, in their eyes, look or will potentially act different. Sometimes just appealing to a xenophobe's better nature simply will not work. This is why we need laws against racial discrimination. Yes, actual laws with enforceable punishments to deal with the stoneheads who won't see sense and accept that people should be judged by the content of their character, not by the color of their skin or national origin. Until more people realize this, the ill treatment of non-Japanese residents discussed in these forums will continue unabated. Thus, these forums miss the point when they pass the problem off as mere cultural misunderstanding. Culture is not the core issue here. One can learn culture, but one cannot change race. The point should be that Japanese society must stop the common practice of using race and physical appearance as a paradigm for pigeonholing people. And until we reach a common understanding and an enforceable law on that issue, talking shops like these will just keep spinning their wheels. Are you going to one of these forums? Well then, bring this issue up from the floor. How local governments should protect local rights by passing local ordinances, or jōrei. Kawasaki City has passed one against exclusionary landlords, and so can anyone else. But it's not going to happen until more people call for it. Don't just jaw, we need a law. And I said so on the panel in Saitama. I dare readers to copycat if you get the chance. In fact, I double dare ya. Let's read my third and final Just Because column for today. This is from the Japan Times, May 8th, 2008. It's entitled, Beyond Activism versus Academia. Back in January, I was a panelist at Waseda University's Global Institute for Asian Regional Integration, invited to give an activist's perspective to an academic crowd. Now, academics are a tough audience. In a way, they're the activists' antithesis. Researchers must offer dispassionate analysis, looking at data without taking any sides or showing any quote-unquote bias. This means academics often view the fight for human rights fundamentally differently. For example, when I talk about the nationwide spread of Japanese-only exclusionary signs, academics often become doubting Thomases. To them, a few signs up are not necessarily indicative of a trend. Their issue is a matter of degree, i.e., are there enough signs to demonstrate, say, quote-unquote, statistical significance? For the activist, however, it's a matter of incidence. One Japanese-only sign up is too many. Even one sign is enough to violate the Japanese Constitution and United Nations Treaty. So, naturally, some academics have been rather skeptical when I claim that racial discrimination here is growing in magnitude and scope. One even asserted at this forum that my online naming and shaming of discriminators, which is found at www.davito.org/roguesgallery, R-O-G-U-E-S gallery, .html, no spaces, is counterproductive. That too much, quote-unquote, attacking Japan alienates potential allies. Again, I understand why Never the Twain, the academic observer, particularly in the social sciences, is bound by a prime directive not to interfere with their object of studying when collecting data. Plus, there is an incumbent resistance to making value judgments. Think of cultural imperialism, etc. To an anthropologist, I'm probably the Antichrist. In sum, academics observe societal or global standards. Activists, however, try to create or adjust them. So, during the Q&A, I made the case that praxis makes perfect, that academics also need to be more activist. The following essay, taking almost verbatim from a recording, sprung from nowhere, and I quote myself. Let's do a meta discussion here about the whole global standards thing, because this is really at the bedrock of our argument. Whenever we look at globalizations and global standards, well, who sets those? It's not really clear. If we look at America as an example of a world standard setter, we might say, oh, well, they're having a xenophobic wave. They're actually instituting fingerprinting for other people. So other countries might start doing it too. Well, look at Britain. They're bringing it in voluntarily for people that want to go through the border smoothly. Yes, but just because a couple of other countries in the world do it does not mean A, it's happening everywhere so it's indicative of a trend, or B, that it's justifiable. We, as activists, don't say, this is okay because other people are doing it. Our starting point is more, what's the better way for people to reach a good potential within the society that they live in? What will help people live more successful, fulfilling lives? As opposed to, what's the best way to observe, control, or monitor? I'm afraid the Japanese government still has the attitude of not making things easier for non-Japanese to integrate and associate. It's a matter of policing and control, especially when you hand over issues of immigration over to police forces. They will always look at it from the point of view of, how do we keep order? How do we make sure that our laws are being followed? The problem is that the police's rubric is not, foreigners are also being legal and following the laws too. They focus on the bad things. It's almost constantly an attack. And as a person in the audience commented earlier tonight, he's the victim of that attack. Whenever he walks out to the supermarket, the police check on him, thinking he might be a lawbreaker. And that's what I was talking about at the very beginning of this presentation. Let's talk about the good things that foreigners do, too. Don't just attack. We have to untie this attitude of making the enforcement of law based upon physical appearance. There are ways to untangle that, but you have to break out of the whole meta-argument of A, any criticism of Japan is a bad thing, or B, global standards are encouraging this right now. As researchers, of course, we can only look at the trends. But our steps as activists is to say, what is the better path to choose, and to give advice. And I think that is what our research should also be leaning towards, how to nudge things in a more positive direction. Because if we don't, we just sit back and look at trends as dispassionate academic observers saying, things are getting bad, ah well. That's really a half measure. It doesn't really help anyone. Even corporations are thinking about corporate social responsibility. I think there's a certain degree of academic social responsibility that we can engage in when we are advising people in these difficult times of globalization to try and find ways to help people lead better lives. All right, and that will do it for the Davito.org podcast for October 31st, 2009. I'd like to thank Trans-Pacific Radio, as always, for hosting this podcast, and I'd like to leave you, as always, with a Duran Duran tune. You heard White Eagle by Tangerine Dream in between my essays. This is a song called Anyone Out There. It's off their first album, and it's from a bootleg this time. This is their earliest known recording of them live with Glasgow, October 31st, 1982. It's called Anyone Out There, and it is surprisingly hot. It's almost 30 years old to the day. Thanks for listening.
Good afternoon, everybody in Glasgow. We're the Cool Kids of the Land. Is there anyone out there?
Oh.